Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Andrea, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop. And today's program is titled Advances in the Treatment of Lung Cancer, and this is part one of a two-part series called Living with Lung Cancer. We have wonderful speakers on our program today, and today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and also many other lung cancer organizations. I just want to say a word about, we have partnered with Free to Breathe, lungcancer.org, Lung Cancer Alliance, and Longevity Foundation. So, in addition to all the other organizations, and because of your interest in the program today and also all of our outreach to all of you, we have on the program today over 665 participants, and you come from all of the United States, and we also have international participants from Canada, Egypt, Turkey, Singapore, and United Kingdom. So you really are really from all over the world in a bit of a global call, and it's a credit to you that you're spending the next hour with us to learn more about really advances in the treatment of lung cancer. Now, today's program was made possible supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb, Novartis Oncology, Pfizer, an independent educational grant from Merck and Company, Inc., and supported by a grant from Genentech. And I really want to thank them for all of the support of this two-part series, and also for their corporate partnership and support of this program, collaboration in making this program possible. Now, we have great speakers today. I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Heather Wakely. Dr. Wakely is Associate Professor, Department of Medicine, Division of Oncology, Stanford University, Stanford Cancer Institute. Dr. Wakely is going to present an overview of lung cancer, the role of precision medicine in informing treatment decisions, and chemotherapy and targeted cancer therapies. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Wakely.
Thanks, Carolyn. It's great to be on. So I just wanted to start by saying that we've seen tremendous advances in what we're able to do to help patients living with lung cancer, especially in the past decade. And just to highlight that we had six new drugs for lung cancer approved in 2015, several of them the new immune therapy drugs that we'll be hearing about more from Dr. Hellman. But it's really an exciting time in the field of care of lung cancer patients and really a time of a lot more hope. So when someone is facing a lung cancer diagnosis, it's always a difficult time, but there are, like I said, many, many treatment options that we now have available. And with that diagnosis, the first question is always going to be stage, so how advanced has the cancer become? And for most people, it's unfortunately usually has spread already to what we call a more advanced stage. And I'm going to be focusing my talk on those patients with more advanced stage cancers. For patients with earlier stages, those are usually going to be best helped by a multidisciplinary discussion with surgeons and radiation oncologists as well as medical oncologists to try to figure out the best treatment plan. For patients with metastatic disease or the advanced stage, stage four, those are all the same in our definition, we're focusing on treatment options that help keep the cancer under control and allow people to live and continue living a full life. So the treatments that we have are, I like to think of them in three different groups. The older but still very important component are the chemotherapy drugs. The next wave were the molecularly targeted agents or quote-unquote precision medicine, and I'm going to be going into more details about that. And then just in the past year, we've had the sort of latest wave, which are the immune therapies, and that's what Dr. Hellman's really going to be focusing on. So I'm going to focus first on the precision medicine and then circle back a little bit to chemotherapy. So a decade ago, when someone was diagnosed with advanced lung cancer, we talked about whether it was an adenocarcinoma or a squamous cell carcinoma or one of the other groups. But aside from that, it didn't really change the options that we had to treat people. Today, instead of focusing just on whether it's adenocarcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma, we need to think about a lot of other things, and those other things are the genetic changes in the tumor or the gene changes, molecular changes, like all of these words can be used to explain the same thing. But essentially what it means is what makes the cancer different from the rest of the person living with that cancer. We now know that for most cancers, there's a single gene change that can be the primary driver or focus of what's causing that cancer. Most cancers, by the time they're found, have many, many gene changes that are different from what's in the person. But there's often a single root change that is what caused the cancer. And we started being able to identify some of those about a decade ago, and the first that we figured out about was called epidermal growth factor receptor, or EGFR. And about 10% of people who have lung cancer, especially the adenocarcinoma type, have a mutation in this EGFR gene in their tumor. And when we're able to find that EGFR gene mutation, we have different sorts of treatments than what we would have otherwise. And those treatments are usually pill drugs. And there are three now that are available for patients with newly diagnosed EGFR mutated lung cancer. And the decision about which of those three to pick is a very individual discussion that a patient and patient's family would have with the physician taking care of the patient and their care team. And between the three options, they're all very, very active, meaning that more than half of patients are going to have a dramatic response to these pill drugs. And so the decisions about which one to use get down to differences in toxicity. And the side effects of these drugs are usually pretty well managed, just some rash and diarrhea. And I think, again, that Dr. Hellman might touch on those side effect management a little bit more. But people, when they're taking these agents, are able to, again, be very active for the most part and live very full lives. The challenge that we face is that none of our treatments last forever. And so when these drugs eventually stop being as effective, as the tumors can figure out ways around them, in the past, our options at that point were then to return to the standard treatments with chemotherapy. But just in the past year, we had approval of another drug. That drug is called osimertinib, and that's a pill drug that patients whose tumor has the EGFR mutation can take when one of those first three drugs, which are erlotinib, gefitinib, and afatinib, when one of those three stop working, we now have this other drug available, which is also a pill drug and also works in the majority of patients when the first treatment stopped working. So that's really exciting. It was just approved at the end of 2015, and it means that we now have sort of that next wave. It also identified the sort of primary changes that lead to that resistance. So when the first three drugs stop working, we can understand for most of the patients why their tumor is no longer responding, and now we have this new agent that can work well. And it's really, I think, the sort of the tip of the iceberg, because with that approval and understanding, we're now at a point of developing sort of the drugs that will work when that one stops working, as well as understanding for patients where that drug doesn't work, what are our other options. So I don't want to confuse everybody, but just to sort of highlight the fact that as we understand the biology of these cancers better, we're coming up with more and more treatments. So EGFR was the first of these molecular changes in lung cancer that we identified. The next one that was discovered was ALK, or ALK. And when there's an ALK change in the tumor, that happens to maybe 5% of lung cancers. We also now have oral medication, pill drugs, that can work very well when the ALK is the driving force in the cancer. So the first of these to be approved is a drug called crizotinib, and that's been available for a few years now. What's really exciting is that we now have two other drugs, ceritinib and alectinib, that also work when there's an ALK change in the tumor. Those other two drugs are both approved to use after the original ALK drug has stopped working. So just like with EGFR, where we have the first and then the next line of treatment, for ALK, we also have the first and then the next line. And where the research is happening in both of those settings is in trying to figure out how do we best sequence those drugs? Are there things we can add to them to help them work longer? And so those are the important questions to be talking about with the healthcare team if you end up having an EGFR ALK tumor. Now, as I mentioned before, as we better understand the biology of the cancers, we're able to come up with new treatments. So while EGFR and ALK are very important discoveries for patients whose tumor have those, it's not everybody. And where we've made tremendous strides, especially in the last few years, is in identifying other molecular drivers of lung cancer. So now when I have a patient who comes to meet me for the first time, we make sure that we're looking for EGFR and ALK before we start chemotherapy. But we now also need to look for about 10 other genes. And that list keeps changing. There are things called ROS1 and RET and MET and BRAF, and I could go on and on. I don't want everyone taking notes on all of those names, but I think the key thing is to make sure that there's an open discussion between patient, their care team, as well as the patient's family about, well, what mutations have we looked for? Have we looked at everything that might change the outcome of the tumor? Are there other treatment options? Because for every patient where we're able to identify one of these gene changes, we're often able to either find a clinical trial or a pill drug that can help them in their journey against this cancer. None of these, unfortunately, are yet curing the cancer, but they're providing time, and that's often very good quality time. So I just wanted to highlight again the importance of doing that testing, of asking your care team about that testing. And I also wanted to touch on the fact that while traditionally these tests have always been done on the tissue, we're now entering an era where we're going to be able to do more and more of this testing for these molecular changes via blood, so blood testing. And that's a really exciting arena. There are a few of these tests already available, but more and more I think we're going to be moving in that direction, especially to monitor over time as we're looking into, well, when these drugs stop working, what's the mechanism and what's going to be the next best choice. Before I close, I wanted to also just come back to that idea about chemotherapy and mention again that chemotherapy is still a very important tool in our treatment of lung cancer, that chemotherapy can work well for a lot of patients for a period of time, and with the right dosing and supportive medications can be quite well tolerated. So I just want to emphasize that we've got tremendous advances that have been made in understanding the molecular underpinnings of the cancer and with precision medicine, but not to run away completely from chemotherapy because it still can play a very important role and to give quality time for patients who are living with this illness. So with that, I'm going to close and let us move on to the next speakers, and I know we'll be available to come back to questions later.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Wakely. That was really outstanding and really set the wonderful tone for today's program and stage. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Matthew Hellman. Dr. Hellman is a medical oncologist, assistant attending physician, thoracic oncology service, Division of Solid Tumor Oncology, Department of Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Hellman is going to discuss new treatment approaches, how clinical trials contribute to treatment options, and managing side effects and pain. It's now my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Hellman.
Thank you very much, and thank you to you all for joining this call. It's pretty cool to be able to connect in this way. Before talking much more about immunotherapies, which obviously has been sort of a hot topic recently, I did want to just reiterate and emphasize what Heather had finished on in saying that despite all of the, I think, really important and interesting advances in both molecularly targeted therapies and immunotherapies that we'll discuss today, chemotherapy remains a really important treatment option for patients with lung cancer. It can work. It can be given in ways that allow people to live their lives in important ways. And so I'm cautious sometimes that so much of our discussion about new things sort of leaves people feeling like they want to run away from chemotherapy. And I would frame some of our advances being additional opportunities, more opportunities and ways to treat cancers, not replacements for treatments of the past. And chemotherapy really can be an important tool. And I think that's an important point to emphasize in these conversations. But it's true that clinical trials over the course of the last about 5 years or so have ultimately led to the recent approval of new immunotherapies for lung cancer in 2015. A lot of people don't think much about their immune system, and there's good reasons for that. And so sometimes it's worthwhile to take sort of a step back and talk about what the immune system is, and then talk about how it may be leveraged as a weapon against cancer. Your immune system is a part of your own body that is meant to try and keep you safe from things that shouldn't be there, things that are foreign, like bacteria or viruses. If you've ever had a strep throat, you might remember when lymph nodes in your neck got big or painful. And that's your body's immune system reacting to a virus or bacteria that was found, and its fight against that infection to help get you better. And that experience of getting sick and those lymph nodes getting bigger is also a good example of how the immune system is controlled in your body. You want this immune system there to survey you and to keep you healthy, but if there isn't something to fight off, you want it to be sort of quiet in the background and something that you don't think of. And then you also want it to be able to quickly ramp up if you were to encounter an infection. This is sort of the idea behind things like getting the flu vaccine each year. By exposing your body's immune system to a little piece of the flu virus, if you were to interact, if you were able to come in contact with the flu sometime later in the season, the hope is that your body will be better able to fight it off in the future. And it seems like some of these same sort of principles may well be true for cancers, too. And some of the initial clues that cancers and the immune system and maybe even infections all connect with each other came from some initial observations in the late 1800s, in which people who developed infections but also had cancers sometimes had their cancers get smaller once they got better from the infection. And so it seemed that as your body was fighting off an infection, it seemed that perhaps as a bystander also capable of fighting off cancers. And so that had prompted some surgeons in the 1800s to try a new idea of taking pus from infections and injecting them into cancers as a way to try and treat cancers. And somewhat remarkably, that worked sometimes. But unfortunately, also, it sometimes was dangerous and had led to the patients who were injected ultimately developing an infection and suffering from that. So as you might imagine, that didn't really take hold. It then took about a century or so for people to start to better understand how can we safely and effectively modulate our immune responses to cancer to be able to come up with new treatments that can be used for patients. And as we go back to the idea of your immune system having this capacity to increase substantially when needed and to go back into the background when it's not, it's useful sometimes to think about the immune system as having both an accelerator and a brake. And that's a natural part of the biology of your immune system to be able to ramp up and then to quiet back down. And that's generally a good thing. It works when coordinated against infections. But it can also be taken advantage of by cancers that are trying to avoid an immune response. And that cancers, it seems, can step on the brakes of your immune system and prevent an effective response and allow the cancer itself to continue to grow. And so some of the medicines that have been developed over the course of the last few years interact with that, those sort of accelerator and brake of your immune system, in order to counteract what the cancer's doing and allow your immune system to become reinvigorated again and hopefully be able to fight off your cancer. So then the concept of immunotherapy, at least in lung cancers, has largely been using medicines to be able to interact with your immune system to allow your own immune system to overcome the breaks that a cancer puts on it and be able to fight again this cancer that's growing in the body. It may be that this process of the immune system interacting with cancers happens all the time, and that it may be that in all of us each day there are cancer cells that crop up before we even notice them, and that they get deleted by the immune system before we know it was there. But in someone whose cancer is growing, evidently that cancer has found some way of avoiding the immune system or preventing the immune system from working. And so the job of medicines in that context is to try and re-stimulate the immune system and try and reestablish some control over the cancer. And that's sort of the, at least the theory of how these things work. But what has been really remarkable, starting since about 2012 and onwards, is the fact that these medicines truly can work. IV medicines that are given about once every 2 or 3 weeks truly have the potential to reprogram your body's immune system and to reinitiate responses against cancers. What's been remarkable about these clinical trials over the course of the last several years has been that responses are seen across people with a variety of cancers, These medicines seem to work in melanomas, lung cancers, kidney cancers, Hodgkin's lymphoma, breast cancers, and others, which I think highlights the importance of the immune system and its interactions with cancer in a broad scope, not just specific to lung cancer, but it really is something fundamental about the way cancers and the immune system interact, and gives us one of the biggest new weapons to treat a variety of cancers. But in each cancer that these medicines have been tested, it only works in some people. It unfortunately only works in a minority of people who get the medicines. And at least for the moment, we don't really have good prediction tools to figure out who are the people who would best benefit from these medicines. So it leaves us with at least two major challenges. And one is, how can we identify with more precision and more personalization the people who best benefit from these medicines that have already been approved by the FDA? And how do we develop either new medicines or new combinations of medicines that can better help more people? And so those are the two main challenges of clinical trials and research moving forward from here. But the research that has been done has now given us at least two new medicines, which you've probably seen advertisements for, at least one of them on television. One of them is called nivolumab, or Opdivo. And the other one is called pembrolizumab, also called Keytruda. As I'd mentioned, these are medicines that are given by an IV. They're given either once every 2 weeks or once every 3 weeks, and truly can be important treatment options for patients with lung cancer. They're currently approved in the United States for people that have previously had at least one type of chemotherapy, but unfortunately that chemotherapy hasn't worked, and they need to find a new treatment option. It's in that setting that these new medicines are approved. It may be with new clinical trials that are ongoing over the right now that the space in which we use these medicines could change. There are some clinical trials that are comparing the first type of chemotherapy you might get to these immunotherapies to see which one's better. And so this space is continuing to evolve. But for the moment, they're approved for people who have previously had chemotherapy and that chemotherapy has started not to work. I think there are probably a few important concepts when thinking about the clinical aspects of immunotherapy treatment. One is that sometimes when we talk about the immune system as a weapon against cancer, the fact that it's your own body's immune system gives it a sense of it being particularly natural and therefore unequivocally safe. And it's true that these medicines are largely well tolerated. There can be important side effects, and I think that's an important thing to emphasize. Not to be scary about the medicines, but to highlight that things can happen and that it's important that people who are getting treated with these medicines have a close relationship with their doctor and close communication if they notice new things. When your immune system is stimulated by these medicines, the hope is that they go to target your cancer. But it's possible that the immune system could go awry and target your own body instead of the cancer. You may know people that have autoimmune diseases like lupus or Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. These are diseases of the body where the immune system is attacking you. And the medicines that we give, these immunotherapies, have the potential to mimic some of those diseases and have your own body turn against you and cause inflammation in other organs of your body, including the lungs or the bowel or the skin. But essentially, any organ could potentially be affected. Fortunately, it is rather rare that serious side effects occur with these medicines. And most people feel well, and I think most people feel better than when they're receiving chemotherapy. But side effects can happen. They can look like anything and can happen at any time. And so it requires some close vigilance by both the patient and their treating doctors and nurses to help keep them safe. Another sort of concept in the context of immunotherapy that I think is worth touching on is the idea of what has been called pseudoprogression, the idea that sometimes the cancer grows before the cancer gets smaller again. This was found in the initial studies of these medicines, and is a real departure from the way that we typically think of medicines working. You probably, if you're a patient, you may have experienced where you get a CT scan and find that the cancer is growing, and that almost always is indicative that the medicine isn't working and a change is needed. Sometimes with immunotherapies, that's not the case. Sometimes there can be an initial growth of the cancer before later the cancer shrinks. And again, that concept has been called pseudoprogression and has led to the idea that sometimes it's worthwhile to continue treatment even if it looks like the cancer is growing. The reason I wanted to touch upon this idea is that although it has become widely discussed, at least in patients with lung cancer, it's quite rare that this occurs. It can happen, but rarely. And so what I have been cautioning both patients and other doctors alike is that the idea of continuing treatment, despite there being a growth of the cancer, really has to be put into the context or seen through the lens of how the patient's doing. If a patient is doing quite well and otherwise feels well, perhaps even better than when they started treatment, That may well be right, that this is pseudoprogression and that with continued therapy, the cancer will shrink yet again. But in people who are otherwise feeling poorly, it's almost never a pseudoprogression. And I think it's important that we as a community start to talk about how best to take care of people on immunotherapies so that we don't needlessly continue treatments that aren't working, but also maximize the time on treatments that are working. And so given that that concept is out there, I just wanted to mention that briefly. But that's a little bit about sort of the idea of immunotherapies, why we're using them, that they are an important new treatment for patients and can profoundly affect the lives of patients who benefit. We have a lot of work left to do to better understand who are the people that best benefit and how do we develop new immunotherapies for the future. And I thank you all for your help in that.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Helmer. That was really very informative and really outstanding, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thanks so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Maria Warner-Wasik. Dr. Wasik is a radiation oncologist. She's Professor Residency Program Director, Department of Radiation Oncology, Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. And Dr. Warner-Wasik is going to focus on the role of radiation oncology in treating lung cancer and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's now my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Warner-Wasik.
Hello, and thank you for allowing me to speak about my favorite topic, which is the use of radiation therapy in patients with lung cancer. I have been doing this for 20 years or so, and I've seen a lot of technology improve over the years, and I am very happy personally that we can localize and see the tumors better and target them better and minimize side effects for patients. It's really been extremely rewarding, and patients do appreciate it. I was asked to start possibly with commenting on different types of radiation therapy, since there's many names used and patients, and also referring physicians are not really confused what is best. So traditionally, most of radiation therapy for lung cancer happens with the use of so-called external beam radiation therapy, which means that the radiation energies, radiation beams, come from outside of the patient and then are aimed at the tumor in the body, mostly in the lung, and then exit on the other side. And the workhorse of radiation therapy is a large machine called the linear accelerator, which produces high energy X-rays, similar to those X-rays you are all familiar with while getting a chest X-ray, for example, except that the X-rays used for treatment of cancer are much stronger, million times stronger than those used for a chest X-ray. But the concept is the same. It's a non-invasive treatment, the treatment which the patients cannot see or feel or smell They most commonly would lie quietly on the table while the radiation machine delivers treatments with radiation beams either from different angles or actively while rotating around the patient and dispensing X-rays. So in other words, the high-energy X-rays or photons are the type of radiation which is delivered in most patients, and it's very reliable, very precise these days, image-based, meaning that we can precisely pinpoint based on CAT scan, PET scans, MRI scans, and so forth, where to aim to maximally dose with radiation the tumor and spare or relatively spare the surrounding normal tissues to the best of our ability. Many of you probably heard about protons as a mode of treatment with radiation therapy. Protons are different than those X-rays I mentioned. Protons are particulate radiation, meaning that they have a mass. They're not just pure energy like X-ray traversing through the body. So since protons have mass, they're heavier. They don't travel as far in the body, and they have a fairly high entrance dose, but also do not exit simply beyond the tumor. And their range, how deep they go in the body, can be modulated with sophisticated techniques to try to focus protons to the area of interest where the tumor sits and relatively spare normal tissues beyond the tumor. So protons are very exciting in theory, and there are several large institutions in the United States which are using protons. Whether there are they are better than simple X-rays or photons in treatment of lung cancer is not fully resolved. There are several ongoing clinical trials in single institutions and also combined between many institutions joining into consortia. And we should know within a few years whether photons or protons are better or whether there are specific circumstances for which protons may be better and whether they cause less toxicity and less side effects. Many of you might have heard also about something called SBRT or stereotactic body radiotherapy, which can be given either with protons or photons without apparent difference as much as we can tell. And that's used for usually for a patient with very early stage lung cancer, stage 1 lung cancer to be more precise, when there is really a single nodule or small mass in the lung and the patient cannot receive surgery, since surgery with lobectomy or removal of the lobe of the lung is the standard therapy for such early stage lung cancer. So, but there are several circumstances where patients either have poor lung functions, already had prior surgical resections of lung tumors, or have other medical issues such as severe heart problems and cannot undergo anesthesia and so forth. Some people also do not wish to receive surgery and choose to get this stereotactic body radiotherapy. So this SBRT is given usually over a very few treatments, as few as 3, sometimes 5, sometimes 7 or 8, and is extremely effective. Well, it makes sense for small lung cancers. We can deliver very large doses or fractions of radiotherapy, 10 times larger on the average than the standard radiation for lung cancer, for example, stage 3, which would take on the average of 6 weeks of daily treatment. So we as radiation oncologists are very excited about using SBRT, and patients tell us that they are perpetually pleasantly surprised how easy it was and how effective this type of treatment is. So there is another term many of you might have heard, so-called IMRT, or intensity modulated radiation therapy. You can tell that we as radiation oncologists like abbreviations. And IMRT is a particular type of sophisticated radiation therapy using non-uniform intensity of the radiation beam as it enters the patient. So that this allows the shaping of the radiation beam around the tumor and further sparing of normal tissues. This IMRT or IMPT can be also applied with protons, but it's really in its infancy when it comes to application with proton treatments. So another term which is frequently used is IGRT, image-guided radiation therapy, meaning that every day while the patient is on the treatment table, we perform a quick CAT scan with the patient in the treatment position, lasting literally 1 minute or 2 minutes. So we are able to verify on the treatment table whether the spot we're aiming at, the tumor, is exactly in the same position as based on treatment planning. So it really gives us great confidence with daily verification with IGRT that we're aiming in the right spot. And patients also feel very assured that there is this verification, that there is minimized room for errors and increased precision. I just want to mention that radiation therapy is used I would say increasingly in all stages of lung cancer. Stage 1, I already mentioned, SBRT. For stage 2 and 3, medically inoperable patients, it's used in combination with concurrent chemotherapy. For stage 4, with tumors which have metastatic disease outside the chest, it's used to palliate or improve symptoms of brain metastasis, tumors in the brain, in the bone, in the other parts of the body, very effective in minimizing pain from bone metastasis, very effective in stopping bleeding in the lung from lung cancer. It's also being applied as prophylactic cranial irradiation in special cases of small cell lung cancer, those patients who had a great response to chemotherapy, and on and on. There's also an emerging field of using radiotherapy for so-called oligometastatic patients, those patients who seem to have disease outside the chest, outside the lung, but it's very limited, and that's an emerging field, and it's we don't know exactly who are the best patients for such approach, but it's being practiced more and more. With regard to quality of life, the last topic I'm supposed to address, I think patients have to be vocal about their symptoms and request palliative care consultations, and not to discount the role of radiation therapy for painful bony metastasis, for example, which allows, in turn, limiting the amount of painkillers, frequently narcotic painkillers, with all attendant side effects such as long-term constipation, cognitive function problems, sleepiness, and so forth. So always communicate with your team and be vocal about your problems. There's many ways in which palliation or improvement of symptoms can be accomplished these days. I would like to stop here, and I will be happy to answer questions later.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Winowacek. That was really outstanding and very comprehensive and very informative. I think for many people on the call, they learned a great deal, and I know that it'll be useful to them in their care, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden. Ms. Bearden is a dietitian, and she is a supervisor of clinical nutrition at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Bearden is going to address nutrition and hydration concerns and eating tips. Now it's my pleasure to turn this program over to Ms. Bearden.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm so excited to be part of today's presentation related to lung cancer. So most treatments for lung cancer, have it be from surgery, radiation, or chemotherapy, can affect your eating. These treatments may increase your need for nutrition, and you may even require some diet modifications to improve the tolerance of eating. But eating well during your treatment can definitely impact your recovery, your healing, and it can also reduce treatment delays. It can also help with keeping your energy level up, so reducing the possibility for fatigue. So a dietitian can assist you by providing you ideas for meeting your individual nutritional goals. Just talk with your healthcare team if it's not something that you're presented with. Reach out to them and let them know that you would like some assistance. So as we start to look at the diet, kind of just a basic approach is looking at the calories. And we actually get calories from a lot of different sources. Sometimes we just think about, eat a hamburger or eat dessert and just get those calories in and try not to lose weight. But that's kind of an older way of thinking, just grabbing something and eating it. We're trying to really focus more on how the food's nutrients and how the nutritional quality of the food is before suggesting it. And so calories actually come from our carbohydrates, our fat, and our protein. We get these from a variety of different foods, but again, thinking about the foods that you're eating before you consume them for the overall benefit of the food. Helping meet your calorie needs, talking with a dietitian, she can help you determine what those calorie needs are. Sometimes you'll have to maybe switch to small frequent meals if your appetite is depressed or if you've been sleeping a lot and you just haven't been able to eat a lot at one time, focusing on nutritional quality, high calories, high protein with those small frequent meals can really help you achieve your calorie goals and halt any possible weight loss or weight changes. There are some foods that are fortified. And there are ways that you can actually fortify your food. I always tell patients eating food is the preferred way. And I know that sounds pretty simple, but there are a lot of products out there that are modulars or they're in a, pre-prepared in a can. And sometimes that's okay. And sometimes there's a better option to at least start with. So meeting with your dietitian to say, hey, listen, I'm having these side effects. Can you help me find the right foods for me? There are a lot of products on the market, and sometimes this can be overwhelming. It can be confusing. Labels don't always represent what the food is best for or the product is best for. So before you go and purchase a lot of supplements or powders or anything, modulars, talk with your healthcare team. Oftentimes, appreciating what else is in the product is important, not just the calories and how much protein it has, even though that's what we tend to gravitate towards. So it's the whole picture. And some of these supplements, they really, you want someone to take a look at them before you start consuming them. But so as we break it down and we look at protein, protein is important for several things. It's part of our weight maintenance, but it also helps with healing. And with weight maintenance comes protecting your lean muscle mass. And there's kind of a thought sometimes I hear from patients come out in conversation where they're like, oh, I have weight to lose. It's no big deal. But actually, when you're going through cancer treatment, depending on where you are and what your process is and what your experience is, it actually does matter. You know, weight loss isn't just fat, and it's kind of a mindset a lot of people have just because of our society and, in general, what people think is I'm going to lose weight, it's all fat. Well, that's not necessarily the case. Oftentimes when you're losing weight due to cancer, you could be losing equitable amounts of both protein and fat. And so fat is going to be lost, obviously, but we don't want to lose the protein or the muscle. Let me rephrase that, muscle. We want to keep that lean muscle mass because the tissue itself, the lean muscle mass, helps us have, keep that endurance. It helps us get up and do the things we want to do. It gives us that support that we need to stand up and move around. So we want to hold on to that lean muscle mass. And in order to do that, it's the big picture of consuming enough calories. And again, going back to talking with your healthcare team about what might be your goals. But some protein sources that oftentimes people forget about, but, of course, dairy products, cottage cheese, yogurt, eggs are a great protein source, your fish, lean proteins like, your white-breasted chicken or turkey. You can even get protein from some plant-based foods, and those are things like our nuts, peanut butter. There's not a lot of protein in peanut butter, but there's some protein, and there's some ways to increase that as well. We can also get protein from other plant-based foods like tofu. There's protein in a lot of our seafood you don't think about. So it's pretty broad spectrum. There's even some plant-based proteins that we oftentimes forget, such as quinoa, which is also a complete protein. So based on what your needs are and what your food preferences are, for whatever reason, talking with your team, they can help you individualize that. Again, with protein, there's a lot of supplements out there, and not all are created equal. So talk with your healthcare team again before starting a supplement or a product. The reason why I keep saying that is because some of the products that are out there related to, you know, getting you a high-calorie or a high-protein modular or supplement oftentimes have other things added to them. Sometimes it's herbs and supplements that you don't necessarily want to have at the time of treatment. Maybe the form of the protein isn't optimal. Maybe there's one that might be better tolerated. So just talking with your team about that. Fluid and hydration. So this is oftentimes not on the forefront of our minds because we are thinking about eating and holding on to the weight that we have and not losing anything that we don't need to lose. But hydration is important for a number of reasons. When you're dehydrated, it can really amplify your side effects. It can make your nausea feel more significant. It can give you headaches. It can you can feel fatigued. You can feel dizzy. A lot of things. It can actually cause where your mouth is dry and foods just don't taste good. So it's anything at room temperature that's liquid is considered a fluid. And so if you're having challenges getting fluids in, talk with your team because oftentimes what we'll say is drink before your meals, drink a certain time after your meals, because if you're getting full, we don't want you to get full on fluid, but eat your meal. So working that fluid in throughout the day is really important. You know, dehydration is one of those things that can also delay your treatments. I know oftentimes patients will come in and they'll have to have fluid administered before they can have their chemotherapy, which can stretch out the time that they're here for. And if you're not feeling well and you're already here for, you know, a couple of hours or more, adding on that extra time can really be uncomfortable. So drinking your fluid throughout the day is what we recommend. If you're finding that you feel like, hey, I feel like I'm eating all right, I'm eating enough, but why am I still losing weight? Have someone who's with you or even in yourself if you feel like you can do it, keeping a diary of what you're eating, especially when you're tired and you're fatigued. Things can seem more than they are. You're feeling full. I've eaten about the amount that I would normally eat. And so gradually over time, 100, 200 calories a day difference to 500 calories a day difference, for example, can make a real impact on your weight change. And in your everyday life, that may not even be something that you pay attention to. But, again, based on your energy level, how much you're awake, that sort of thing can really impact the frequency in which you're eating. Also, the types of food that you're eating may change. And so if you're having, by chance, you know, any reconstructive procedure, if the texture's changed or if you've been on a tube feeding or something like that and you're out of your normal process and you're working to try and eat again, a lot of things can come into play, so keeping a daily record can be useful, and you may only have to do it for a couple of days, and then really just that'll be enough a lot of times for patients to recognize, oh, wow, I didn't realize I wasn't eating that much, and your healthcare team can help calculate what you are taking in based on that. So I mentioned a minute ago about diet modifications, and sometimes swallowing can be an issue. Sometimes treatment, just depending on if you're getting radiation in the area that's being affected, if you'll have trouble with your swallowing, some pain with swallowing. Sometimes with surgery, if you have surgery, there's a period of time or based on what your situation might be, starting out with particular textures may be recommended, and working with a speech pathologist may be part of your plan. Oftentimes, patients who've had surgery will have a tube feeding for support, just to bridge them during the postoperative period while consuming until they're able to consume enough by mouth. So there's a lot of different possibilities that you might be experiencing or see others experience that may be different from yours just based on what their needs are. I'm going to touch just briefly on bowel function, and this goes back to hydration oftentimes. A lot of patients, again, aren't drinking enough, and they're experiencing constipation. There may also be issues with diarrhea based on the treatment. So if you're maybe getting a treatment, a chemotherapy, or another type treatment that's a side effect is diarrhea, follow the directions that your healthcare team provides you, especially when it's caused by a chemotherapy or a treatment. They're going to give you some very specific ways to address it, and so you want to follow those recommendations as they're presented. Even if you're feeling okay, go ahead and follow them, because that protocol may be what's helping you continue to feel well. But constipation can also come from anti-nausea medications, and it can also come from pain medications, just for a couple of extra examples. So, going longer than 3 days without a bowel movement, talk with your team. That may be something that they want you to start doing something to intervene on. But for the most part, just remembering that your needs are individual. So just because one person's doing something a specific way you may talk to in the lobby doesn't mean that's the best way for you. So take advantage of everyone on your healthcare team to help you understand your needs and how specific they are for you accomplishing the goals and helping through your treatment.
Thank you so much. This is really fantastic, Diana. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. This is really amazing information, which I think it's just so helpful to everyone on the call, so thank you so much. And so thank you, and we're going to move on to questions in just a minute. I just want to actually say just a few words about some of the participants have asked about just the services they can access from Cancer Care, so I just want to say a word about that, and then we'll move right on to questions. Being diagnosed with lung cancer, or any type of cancer, kind of turns your world upside down, and people often have emotional and practical and financial and just social concerns that they have. We call psychosocial concerns. And Cancer Care is a national organization, and we provide free services to people living with all types of cancers, including lung cancer, of course. And we have specific programs for people with lung cancer. And so what do those programs look like and services? So we have a large staff of oncology social workers. There's social workers who work with people who have cancer. They're part of the healthcare team. And indeed, today's program has really represented the entire multidisciplinary team, actually, when you think about it. We've had a medical oncologist, radiation oncologist, dietitian, social worker. So to some extent, all that team. And it takes a whole village and your family and friends and network to kind of really help with all the support that you need. So we do offer practical and financial assistance. We also offer a chance to talk with one of our oncology social workers in terms of getting some counseling help for free on the telephone, online. And we also offer telephone and online support groups, which many people find very helpful. And many of our international participants also participate in our online support groups, because those actually are, they're kind of, there's no specific time, and people can post at any time of the day or night, so that really helps with that kind of international or change of time zone that everybody's on. We also have workshops like this, and of course we have various publications, and we have sort of a website, of course, for our international participants who, or anyone who wants to kind of post a question or get in touch with one of our social workers. They can contact www.cancercare.org and access our services in that way. Now we're going to take time for questions from our audience, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get your question, then I will, of course, tell you how to get your questions answered. But we're going to start with Andrea explaining to you how to queue up for questions. So, Andrea.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question from the phone lines comes from the line of Allison S. Your line is open.
Go ahead. Yes, my wife has been on Opdivo 1 year starting in March. There have been some interruptions because of asthma and bronchial pneumonia, of which she suffered last month. She was off a month. She's had one infusion recently. And my question is there, oh, by the way, and she's doing, it's been very successful. The question is, are there possible breaks for Opdivo? For example, if one's planning or is it going, so long as there are no interdictions, does it have to be every 2 weeks? That's it.
Excellent. Well, thank you. That's an excellent question. And I'm going to ask if Dr. Wakeley could address the question in a general way, and then we definitely recommend that you go back to your treating healthcare team with all the specifics about your wife's situation. But Dr. Wakeley, could you just address the concept of sometimes people do want to go on a trip or something and what happens, and also the asthma and the bronchial issues as well, just in general?
Certainly.
Way.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I'll go with the first question first. We really try to make sure that patients have as much flexibility as possible as far as being able to live their lives. And so I always encourage my patients, if they've got a trip planned, an important family event, that it's okay to take a break. Now, we don't want to do that every cycle because the drugs have been studied to be given in the frequency they're done. So with the nivolumab Opdivo, it is an every 2 week regimen. Which is different from the pembrolizumab, which is every 3 weeks, and the chemo drugs have their set schedules. But there is certainly room for flexibility. So if every once in a while you need a 3 or even a 4 week schedule, that's going to be fine. And the same with the chemotherapy drugs. We're really, our goal is to help people live their lives. And so being tied to always have to come in on exactly the same day every 2 weeks can really cause some problems there. As far as the taking breaks for side effects, that's really going to depend on the specifics of the situation and talking to the care team, but we do have to do that sometimes, and we know it's far better to take the break and let someone recover before restarting than to try to push through. So hopefully that answered.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question, Andrea?
Yes, our next question comes from the line of Julie P. Your line is open.
My question is I have been on Opdivo since October, and it's been very well, but I feel great on it. My question is, though, is if my tumors have been shrinking with my scans, and I do have it in my pelvic bone, too, and everything seems to be shrinking, but if at any time if there's a new tumor, or if I see the cancer coming, you know, coming back in my pelvic bone or someplace else, do they automatically take you off that Opdivo and try something different? Because I did not qualify for any of the pills. I wasn't a match for any of those. So what would be like the next step going forward if Opdivo stops working, I guess?
So that's a great question. Thank you. I'm going to ask if Dr. Hellman, if you could address that question. Excellent question. Thank you. In a general way, and then we'll, of course, Julie, invite you to go back to your treating healthcare team. But if you could address it generally, Dr. Hellman.
I think there's probably two parts to that question. One is in people who are doing quite well, as you are, which is fantastic, what happens when sort of one spot becomes a new problem, whether it's a lymph node or a bone area? Sometimes we have seen that happen where the rest of the cancer spots on the body look like they're continuing to be under control, but one area seems either new or growing or painful. I think it opens a somewhat new paradigm, which is to try and sort of deal with that one spot with things like radiation or surgery while continuing on nivolumab if the remainder of the disease remains under control. I think that is a concept that has been borrowed from some of the molecularly targeted therapies, which some of you also may have experienced, where the medicine is working in many spots, but not all, and there needs some special attention to some new areas. And sometimes that can be done with just local procedures like radiation or surgery while still continuing on therapy. The broader question, I think, relates to if nivolumab doesn't work, what else is there? And I think in sort of